beginning by thanking, as I always do, John Lee Hooker, Carlos Santana, for that music and that reminder about change and how it's built into the way we live. Today I'm pleased to be able to say that a guest I had last year has come back, Dr. Harriet Fraud, a person I work with quite a bit, as those of you who follow our work know. She will be joining me in about 15 minutes for an interview on a remarkable phenomena, the increasing number of Americans who choose as adults to live alone, more than at any time in American history, and we're going to explore how that happened, why that happened, and what it means, both in terms of the psychology of our people, Dr. Fraud is a psychologist, and in terms of the economics that is the focus of this program. Well, what is this program? Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been an economist all my adult life, a professor of economics. I currently teach in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. You can follow my economic analyses at www.rdwolff.com. I want to thank, as I always do, Truthout, whose remarkable website is a courageous source of independent news and commentary every day. Check them out at truthout.org. We are interested in your questions and comments. Each week we select one or more and respond on our program. You can email me your questions and comments again to the website www.rdwolff.com. Let us know if you'd like us to mention your name if we can choose one of your questions or comments. And please bear with us. We get more questions and comments than we could possibly answer on the air, and we have to try to choose them to compose these programs. Please also become a fan of the show on Facebook and like our Economic Update page. By following us, you will receive updates about the show and posts of relevant articles and information. You can post questions for me to answer on air there. I will answer some there and some on the air as time permits. I have another announcement besides letting you know that Dr. Fraud will be with us in a few minutes, and that is in kind response to your inquiries. Yes, I did release a book last month, May 2012, that has a lot to do with the kinds of questions I've explored on the air on this program over the last year or so. The name of the book is Occupy the Economy, the subtitle Challenging Capitalism. And as you know, that's the kind of economics I do. So let's jump right in to the updates for today. Well, yesterday the federal government released its usual statistics about unemployment, only they were stunning this time, stunning in a not so happy way, and we have to face that. For May of 2012, the United States economy added 69,000 jobs. That's about half of what we need to begin to reduce unemployment. It's 40,000 jobs fewer than we would need just to keep track of the population growth. That is, that many young people are coming into the market every month, that we would need 40,000 more jobs than we added last month to be able just to provide work for them. We're not able to do that. The results were very, very poor. The worst growth of jobs in the last year, in fact. It raised the unemployment rate from 8.1% to 8.2%. If you count not only the people without work, but those who are stuck in part-time jobs, even though they want a full-time jobs, and those that have quit looking, we're now officially, from the government, at a rate of 14.8%. That's almost one out of six people in the labor force without work or forced to work part-time. The average length of the work week shrank so that there are fewer hours people are getting paid for. And we also saw adjustments in the statistics announced in March and April of this year, both adjustments downward, 11,000 fewer jobs in March than what was originally reported, and 38,000 fewer jobs in April. This is bad news for the economy. And to top it off, average hourly earnings for non-supervisory employees, that's most of us, decreased, went down in May of this year. This means that if you put together the poor unemployment numbers, together with the fact that wages are shrinking, you're looking at an economic system that, with all the talk of recovery over the last few months, is not recovering at all. It is declining in economic well-being. Why is this important? Well, it's important, for example, because it means that the current generation of graduates of high school and college face another grim situation in terms of finding first jobs. Since nobody is giving up a job in this kind of a situation, their prospects are very poor, and that has lifelong implications. Beyond that, it's a powerful political problem, above all for President Barack Obama. Why? He made the decision, a mistake in my view, to hitch his election campaign on the recovery that he kept telling us about. Well, if you hitch your horse to that kind of a wagon, and that kind of wagon start going down the wrong side of the hill, so do you. So Mr. Obama is looking at a difficult situation for himself to get reelected. And in the end, one really can't blame too many others than him. He chose to stay with an economic system, not to be critical of it, to keep in power the very advisors who brought us into this mess, and now he's discovering that their promises that they had the way to get out of it don't pan out. It's going to be interesting to watch. There's a further comment, though, on what we're seeing. This is not a crisis of the United States economy. It's a crisis of a capitalist system that is worldwide now. Let's review briefly. This system, this crisis of the system, hit first in the United States. It basically began in the end of 2007 and ran really badly here in the United States from 2007 to 2009. The Europeans thought they had gotten out of the crisis with relatively little damage, not understanding that it was a crisis of a system, and that if it breaks in one place, it's only a matter of time before the trouble starts elsewhere. So in 2010 to 2012, the crisis was worse in Europe. And the Americans, who were embarrassed at first because it started here and it began here with the housing crisis, thought they were out of the woods. It was now Europe that was in trouble. Yes, but it's a system. So if Europe's in trouble over the last year and a half, and they certainly have been, it's only a matter of time before other parts of the world, like China and the United States, feel the impact. And so now the impact is coming back and hitting here in the United States with these results. Let me give you just one idea of what highfalutin investors are thinking. Over the last week, investors began buying the debt of the German government, bonds issued by the German government that carry a negative interest rate. Let me explain what that means. You give the German government $100 today, and the German government promises to give you back 99 a year from now. That's a 1%, negative 1% interest rate. People are so worried about keeping their money in stock market because of the troubles of capitalism that they feel it is a better investment to give the German government $100 with the promise of getting back 99 than to risk investing that $100 in anything else, like producing something, hiring someone, or even investing in the stocks of corporations. That's how bad it is. Let me turn next to Europe. Certainly an area where there is trouble galore. The crisis continues in Europe. The efforts of the European government to contain the economic crisis of capitalism have been no more successful in Europe than those efforts have proved to be here in the United States. I don't have time today to talk about the problems mushrooming in China, but I will in a future program. Things, however, in Europe have gotten really bad, and so we're beginning to see fairly extreme reactions, and I want to mention three of them just to put it in context. First, in Greece, in a sense the poster child of the European crisis, the place where it hit the hardest, hit early, and has really been bad. They have now voted, literally, in an election to completely transform Greek politics. A coalition of left-wing political parties, the Syriza movement, came in second in the elections held last month. This is a party that denounces NATO, that wants nothing to do with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that is critical of the United States' role most parts of the world, that wants to withdraw from all the deals made by earlier Greek governments about austerity and cutting wages and laying people off. Their plan, government employment, tax the rich. Wow. And they came in second. There are going to be elections later this month in Greece, and the only question is whether this radical left party will come in first and then become the dominant government of Greece, or second, becoming a very powerful, almost as strong opposition. That's a sign of people voting against austerity, against this crisis, and against the way it's been handled by the bankers and the politicians to date. It is a sign of something spreading. Second, the case of Spain, which is now, in a sense, the point player in the European crisis. The Spanish government is in terrible shape. The Spanish economy in worse shape. Official unemployment, 25%. That's in the neighborhood of what it was at the depths of the Depression of 1933 here in the United States. But the interesting thing is, it's not a problem of government debt in Spain. In Spain, for example, the government owes less as a percentage of GDP than the United States government does. That is, it's a less spendthrift government than that of the United States. So what's the problem? Spain borrowed money, or more radically, more honestly, the mass of businesses and individuals in Spain borrowed a lot of money, particularly to fuel a housing boom for the last 10 years. Should sound familiar because it's like the United States. And now, with the global crisis, the people who borrowed and the businesses who borrowed can't pay back. And no one knows what to do. And the Spanish government is being called on to bail out all the banks that made all the loans. Well, let me comment on that in a way you will not read in the newspaper. The celebration of capitalism as a market-driven system is the one that we all relied on over the last 10 years to make sure that bankers didn't lend to people who couldn't pay back, that they took adequate account of the risks of lending and the ups and downs of the capitalist system they always championed to us. And they proved to us that they're not reliable, that the market, which worked so nicely to lend so much money to so many borrowers, didn't do a good job of it, couldn't discern a good borrower from a bad one, didn't make provision for downturns in the economy. In short, the market had a disastrous result that we're watching being played out. In Greece, there's a party that says that. They're not going to rely on the market because it has produced disaster. The Spanish politicians, a conservative group right now, are refusing to make any such admission, and so the economy continues to deteriorate. Last short point, and I will develop this in the future. Why is Germany doing so well when just about all of the rest of Europe, or most of it anyway, is doing so badly? Or to be more honest, why is Germany and the Scandinavian countries, basically, doing reasonably well when most of the rest of Europe isn't? Well, the German miracle is no miracle when you look at it. The crucial thing that happened to Germany over the last 10 years was that the prices there didn't go up. The Germans lent money to everybody else in Europe. Everybody else in Europe borrowed like crazy and bid up the price of land and bid up the price of housing. And then as the price of housing went up, they could borrow more money against the more valuable house. They went into the kind of credit spiral we had here. But the Germans didn't. They kept their prices down. So pretty soon everybody else in Europe was no longer buying Spanish products or Italian products or Greek products. They were buying German products because their prices didn't go up the way everybody else's did. Was this some kind of German miracle? Hardly. Here's an explanation that you won't see in the newspapers, and it's interesting to think about why. Germany benefited in the decade before the last 10 years, that is the 1990s, by something no other country on earth had going for it. That was the collapse of East Germany. The East German communist government fell apart. And It delivered to Germany, West Germany it was used to be called, now it's a unified one Germany. But when the East German government collapsed, it delivered into the hands of the West German capitalist employers a stunning gift. An entire generation of young people in East Germany had been trained, highly educated, used to industrial work, very skilled, among the most skilled in all of Europe. The difference between West and East Germany was that East Germany paid much lower wages than the West. So when the unification happened, East Germany delivered to the West highly educated, highly skilled workers at a wage much lower than had to be paid to anybody else. Of course the Germans didn't have to raise the prices of their output because they were cashing in on cheap workers, highly skilled cheap workers. Nothing like that exists anywhere else in the world. That's why they were able to keep their prices down, and that's why we have a German miracle today. If you want to thank anyone for the success Germany is having now, it would be for those communists in the East and all that they had done. Last update before we turn to our interview. I hear a great deal, as all Americans do, about family values here in the United States. We are told, particularly by our Republican brothers and sisters and our conservatives, that we are a nation committed to the family, that we are a nation that ought to be committed more to the family, 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 family. Well, I recently had occasion to look up what we do for these families that we are so committed to in this country. And what I looked at was the question of parental leave. In other words, how do countries stack up when it comes to providing paid leaves for mothers and or mothers and fathers to care for newborn children? Now, if you want to support a family, then making it easy or easier for people to have children and to nurture them in a loving way would be what you might expect to happen. Well, here's a surprise. I compared governments as follows. Do they provide paid parental leave for families that have two parents, the so-called ideal American family, mama, papa, and the kids, that everybody celebrates? The United States is, get ready now, alone among all of the advanced countries on this planet in providing, by law, no, zero, paid parental leave for workers as a matter of law. Let me give you now some numbers about what other countries do where you don't find such a celebration of the family, where you don't have family values talked about over and over again. France provides 22 weeks of paid leave for people having a baby so the mother and or the father can be with the baby. Germany, the country that's doing so well, that we just talked about, provides 47 weeks of paid leave. That's about a year. So when you hear a conservative explain, we can't afford that here in the United States, then remember that Germany is doing much better in this economic crisis than we are, and they provide 47 weeks. Who else provides 47 weeks of paid leave? Sweden, Norway. Beginning to get the picture? Italy provides 25. Australia provides 18. Canada provides 28. And we provide this country of family values zilch, zero paid leave. Think about it the next time you hear a lecture about family values and their importance in American life and politics. All right, then. So much for our updates. Let me turn to welcome to our microphones on here on Economic Update, Dr. Harriet Fraud. She is a psychotherapist and hypnotherapist in private practice in New York City. Her work may be found on her own website, Harriet Fraud, and I'll spell that for you, .com, H-A-R-R-I-E-T-F-R-A-A-D, HarrietFraud.com. She writes at the intersection, we might say, of economics and personal life. Together, she and I have produced regular podcasts on economics and psychology. You can find them in the podcast section of my website, www.rdwolf.com, and as well on her website, again, harrietfraud.com. Thank you very much, Harriet, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin and jump right in. The topic today is people, adults living alone in the United States. And I know that you have been interested in this topic and that you have mentioned to me, which is part of what brought us to this interview, a new book called Going Solo, which talks about this. So could you begin by giving us a sense of what this living alone phenomena is like in the United States and how it has dramatically come to the fore?
Well, the first thing is to show the extent of it. It's today more than half of American adults are single, and 31 million, roughly one out of seven, live alone. And living alone is now tied with childless couples as the most prominent residential type of household. Adults living alone. And surprisingly, living alone is one of the most stable households that exist. It's over a five-year period, people who live alone are more likely to stay that way than everyone else except for couples with young children. And I should say that couples with young children report the greatest unhappiness with the marriage, but the most likely of staying there. So, and also that these contemporary solo dwellers are women more than men. There's 17 million women living alone and 14 million men. Young adults between 18 and 34 are the fastest growing group of people living alone. So this is very significant phenomenon. And it's not only a significant phenomenon in the United States. More and more people are urbanized in places like Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. Half of people live alone in a big city like Stockholm. 60% of people live alone in Manhattan. 50% of people are living alone.
And has this, could you mention, I should ask, what the book is that has kind of...
Sure, it's called Going Solo.
And who the author is?
And the author is Eric Kleinenberg.
Okay.
And it came out this year.
Could you tell us, does he make a case or does he explain that this phenomena of people, adults living alone, has that grown rapidly? And if so,
it's more than doubled in the last 10 years.
So it's something exploding.
It's a huge phenomenon. Yeah, okay. And it's huge all over the world. In fact, one-person households are growing fastest in the most populous nations in the world, China, India, and Brazil. So it's a global phenomenon. There's been a... In one decade, there's been a third increase in some nations and a 50% increase in other nations. So we're talking about a very significant phenomenon.
Yeah, I was struck that Kleinenberg's book, Going Solo, has a remarkable subtitle, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. So this Eric Kleinenberg, and it's spelled with a K, K-L-I-N-E-N-B-E-R-G, is really writing a book that's becoming a big item because he is on to a remarkable new development of masses of people living alone. I'd like to take our interview into a discussion, if you will, about why this is happening. I mean, what is it about the United States, because this is one of the places where this is happening, that might help us understand why so many people are choosing a single or alone living lifestyle for themselves?
Well, one thing that's happening is particular to the United States or more extreme in the United States, which is that in the United States, starting in the 1970s, wages froze. Instead of wages going up with each generation for white males, at least, because there was always this basic supplement that one had until the 1970s, in which you got an extra supplement for being a male and an extra supplement for being a white. This was never a phenomenon for women, this increasing wages, or for any minority group. But for white males, who were more a majority at that point than they are now, for 150 years, from 1820 to the 1970s, each generation did better than the last. Then in the 1970s, wages froze. Computers and multi very sophisticated electronic communication systems allowed jobs to be outsourced. We didn't have the kind of labor movement that stopped that, and that was a left labor movement, and out they flowed, and that whole phenomenon stopped.
Okay, so
therefore,
yeah, what was the effect? Yeah,
the effect is huge, because the higher white male wage sustained a family form of a dependent wife and children, and a wage earning male whose wage supported a family. He got a family wage whether he had a family or not.
So that became the norm here in the United States.
That was the norm. And
in
that
the century
is what
before the 70s.
The Republicans in their necrophile ecstasy say is the family form that should be resuscitated from the dead, because that's over. At any rate, within that family, women did the domestic work. They took care of the household. They took care of the children. And they created the emotional and social ties for the male who went out to work. We created our suburbs for people who go out to work, leaving dependent wives and children. It's one of the reasons that people are flooding into cities where there's some social services, because women, now half the labor force is female. Women have to work in order to support themselves. And that has changed. So women are financial equals in terms of financial responsibility, but they are not equals for a lot of men in terms of men's assumption of domestic tasks or treating women as equals. So a lot of women are opting out. 65% of divorces are now initiated by women. Women increasingly refuse to get married, because getting married for a lot of men means that they then acquire a household servant, and a lot of women aren't signing up for that after the day of work. And that was so in the minority communities before that. Now it's so across the board. And so that there is a huge change that women are opting to live alone. Also, people can stay connected when they live alone because they have the internet, because they have computers, because they have sophisticated communication system. And that's very, very big. People are connected because they're more and more living in cities where one can be in a social space connected with other people. That's not a rural phenomenon.
So in a sense, the end of rising wages that we've talked about on this program many times since the 1970s set in motion, if I understand you, a series of kinds of consequences, one of which is to break up the traditional family, partly because the wages were no longer rising to enable the male wage earner to sustain that old family. None of this was explained, of course, and no one understood that they were caught up in this social process. So it was worked out as a struggle between each couple or each young person contemplating marriage or family. And slowly we can begin to see this movement towards living alone as a kind of way of coping. Even if it was understood by the people doing it as a personal choice,
right,
it was in fact a way of coping with a changed economic environment.
In fact, here we go again in terms of family values. The irony is capitalist profiteering and the leveling of wages and outsourcing of jobs has contributed to the end of the family form that they claim is the most important thing on the earth. A second irony.
Because of its obvious implications, it's hard not to mention, before we take our break, that the critique, if I can give it a noble term, of the African-American family in years gone by, that it was hard to keep people together, that the husband would leave or that the husband was transient. The irony is, since they never got black men the kinds of income and the kinds of jobs would have been necessary to sustain the family, the white population of the United States is now discovering in its own networks the same kind of problem, and discovering that therefore holding together the family that they thought had some kind of special moral capacity for is dissolving on them as well.
In fact, it's an interesting thing. In 1965, Moynihan wrote the Moynihan Report on the what was called the Negro family then, in which he attributed the breakup of African American families to the pathology of the African American community. And now we have our modern panderer apologist In his 2012 book, Coming Apart, Charles Murray writes, it's the white working class that is immoral, that doesn't have enough religion, that doesn't stay married, and doesn't have those good old American virtues, and that's why marriage and the American economy are falling apart.
Fascinating. I'm going to take a brief break, and we'll come back in just a moment and continue this interview with Dr. Harriet Fraud. Welcome back, folks. I'm engaged here in a fascinating interview with Dr. Harriet Fraud, a practicing psychotherapist and hypnotherapist in New York City. And we've been discussing and will continue to be discussing this remarkable new phenomena here in the United States and in many other countries, as she's explained, in which millions of people who used to choose to live in couples and families are choosing instead to live as single adults with or without children. And we've been talking a bit about what were the causes that produced it. I'd like to change the focus a little bit now and ask, what are the consequences? How do we understand what is happening and what is likely to happen, both economically and psychologically, to a society in which people are making such a radically different personal choice?
Well, the consequences vary enormously, like a lot in American life, depending on how much money you have. Because let's take the case of an elderly person and a young person. Let's say you're an old guy and you have only Social Security to live in. And you live in a city because you can't get around very well. And you live in a dangerous neighborhood and you can't go out and you can't see friends on the street, because it's a little scary to do that, and you don't have the money to get the kind of transportation you need where you don't have to do a lot of walking up and down subway steps, and so you're isolated in your single-room occupancy apartment that you can barely afford, and terribly lonely, linked only perhaps by computer or radio with the world. If, let's say, you are then, instead of poor, if you have your stock and bond income to live off of, or a big pension from years when people got those things, or, you know, were a CEO or something comparable, then you can take cabs all over the place. You can get on the internet and meet a partner of any age. You could even, if you have the money, get on one of the sugar daddy hotlines, support a woman, have regular sex when she's 22 and you're putting her through school. You have a lot of options. You can go to the theater and invite people out. You can go and go to your neighborhood coffee house because you live in a good neighborhood and meet and talk to people there. You can join all sorts of groups because you've got the money. So that's a very different outcome. You have a young person, you have the same problems. If you're a young person and you have money, you can join any of the dating sites and get fixed up that way. You can go to your coffee house. You can go to events around the city. You live in a good neighborhood. You can come home late and you can feel okay. You can go to a bar. You can pick up a stranger. You know, you can do whatever you want because you've got the discretionary income. If you don't have the money, you're much more trapped.
Well, let me explore that a little bit in terms of
lonely.
Yeah, in the economics of it. It's well known that a person who lives alone has higher expenses per person than a person who lives in a group or even in a couple. So a movement of our people from living in groups, at least couples, to living alone means that we're not adequately, as a profession in economics, accounting for the economic difficulties people are having, because we're simply looking at how much money they're earning as an average, and we're not realizing that a growing proportion, now huge in its size, are people who have much more living expenses mm-hmm. than they used to because they're living alone. And therefore, the economic squeeze on people is being underestimated systematically in economic analysis because we haven't taken into account the number of people who are having to spend a relatively higher proportion of their income to live, housing, clothing, cleaning, and all the rest.
And social life.
And social life, because doing it as an individual, living alone, is a much more costly business than having done it as a couple used to do it when that was more the norm.
That
life is becoming harder because financially, because of this movement, so that people live alone because they're responding to economic problems and then discovering a whole new set of economic problems emerging from how they responded to the first set of economic problems.
Yeah, it's very dramatic in New York where rents are so high. It's one thing if it's Sex in the City, you know, those four women who are somehow fabulously wealthy and have great apartments and can go everywhere. And it's another thing for working class people who are struggling and alone and who can't afford a lot of these meet and greet possibilities.
So in a sense, I think also that this is contributing to a growing inequality here in the United States, that this extra cost of living by yourself, in a sense, contributes to a squeeze on everybody at the lower end of the system whose situation is worse, and kind of gives a special set of privileges to those at the top who can take the steps to offset that loneliness you talk about. But let me draw you out a little bit. Tell me something as a psychologist and someone who's practicing and has clients who come out of this situation. How do you see the consequences of living alone playing out in the psychology of individuals in America and how that in turn then affects the economics?
Well, I think one of the things that the United States is afflicted by is a denial of our desperate need to connect as people. We are the most social of all pack animals. Human beings have never survived alone as a species. And there's in the American individualism idea, it's that it's every man for himself, to use only men, but it's every woman, every person for themselves, as if the ideal is not to be interdependent in a cooperative, caring way, but to do everything by and for yourself. Even Thoreau, who lived alone and wrote about how I live alone, his mother brought him his meals, people came and visited. You know, let's be a little realistic here. And I think, you know, that's part of the American experience here. In other countries, it's handled differently. For example, in Sweden, they are building thousands of units to subsidize what they see as a development. They're subsidizing housing for younger individuals to be able to have very tiny apartments and then big meeting rooms and social spaces. Whereas in the United States, they're not.
Let me, before we turn to what might be done and look at some of these efforts in other countries to cope with this situation, I don't want to leave this issue of the consequences of people living alone. Let me push you and ask whether the following sentence would be true, that if people live more and more alone, rather than in couples, with or without children, or in groups, that we might say that the problem of isolation or loneliness is becoming more prevalent, is deepening in the United States? Is that anything either you know from literature or from your own clinical work with patients?
I see that it's getting more and more extreme. The only place that people can go to connect if they don't have money is 12-step programs, which are one of the fastest growing groups in the United States. People are more and more alone. They watch more and more television. The average American watches more than 7 hours of television in which their concerns
per
day.
Whoa.
In which their concerns are belittled. The serious struggles they have to make a life are not handled. And in which there's a right-wing move that slides into, if you only have enough money, you'll be one of those happy young things in the advertisements. And so that people are more isolated and more depressed. Another indication is that 13% of Americans are taking Prozac alone, which is, and there are 30 available antidepressants on the market, Prozac only being the best seller. There are more people taking the anti-anxiety drug Xanax than there are buying Tide detergent. Whoa, we're talking about a $96 billion industry. We're talking about wild profits for psychopharma from hustling these drugs, which are advertised on television. And I should say that we are the only nation in the Western world that allows paid advertising of pharmaceuticals. But we do. But those are indications that people are depressed, people are unhappy, people are alone. If they were organized politically, they might say, of course I feel alone. Here we are, the money that I'm sending in taxes being used to slaughter people and make us hate it all over the world. Something's wrong. I ought to connect with people. But that's not available on TV. And so people are more alone and more depressed, particularly people without money, since television teaches you that money buys happiness.
And as an economist, I can only add that if it is correct that one of the consequences of people living alone, whatever liberation from relationships it provides for some, whatever better way of coping with economic difficulties in our capitalist evolution it may provide, in other words, it has positive value for people who are making that decision, it also carries very dangerous long-term economic consequences, not the least of which is a decline in productivity. Lonely people, frustrated people, people relying on medical help for their psychological conditions are people who are likely to be less productive in 100 different ways than they might otherwise be as they struggle with these crises in their lives like anybody would. So it'll come back to haunt the economy, yeah, or risks doing that in all kinds of ways that haven't been understood or coped with.
Yeah, there's a very strong example of that in that they did try in New York City. They set up an alternative kind of housing for the elderly in which there were big social spaces, big, bright, nice social spaces and small apartments and every encouragement to socialize. They found they saved so much on Medicare because people were less sick that it paid for itself.
That is so astounding for people to think about. In other words, while we are all complaining about the cost of medical care in this country going crazy, and politicians are talking about cutting Medicare help for people, here's a way you could save on Medicare while actually helping people rather than hurting them. If you provided a whole new set of services and supports for the people who are choosing by the millions to live alone, you would do so much for them that they would be less relying on Medicaid and Medicare, and you would realize that that wouldn't cost you anything. Meanwhile, it's infinitely better for those people, so it's a win-win situation of the sort that no political force in this country supports.
There's two things that are important to know, which is that when you feel attacked, assaulted, frightened, lonely, worried, your body secretes something called cortisol, which is to protect you during emergencies. So if you feel like your life is one big emergency, you will secrete cortisol and your immune system will shut off because all unnecessary systems to survival that moment shut off, and therefore you will be much more vulnerable to disease as well as depression. That's why they're always talking about stress. That's the biology of stress. Also, we should say that I feel I should because of my field, that if you're unhappy and you have the money, you can pay a therapist who's trying to help you be strong and cope. If you're not, you go to some doctor who gives you a pill which will at best keep you comfortably numb and never help you get over the issue about which you're depressed, because people aren't depressed for nothing. There's good reasons.
Okay, so I think we've dealt with this living alone both in terms of what brought it into being and what some of its consequences are. Let's close the interview because, as always, we are limited by time. But let me ask you, what have societies begun to do, like Sweden, because you mentioned them before, that have this same phenomena even bigger than we do, at least for the moment? What have they done to cope with it, and what might the United States do if it were willing as a society both to recognize this phenomena and to try to respond in a humane way to it?
One thing is social services, which we're busy cutting. Social services for young people, social services for the elderly. Another is constructing housing differently. And so instead of making, you know, McMansions around or building suburbs, you would build low or mixed income housing with small apartments and big social spaces, which are available for the wealthy. There are places like the Hotel Alcott used to be with small apartments and then a big dining area where people dine together. That's a way of encouraging sociability and allowing people to meet. There are social programs and social spaces that people can have. Another thing is to allow to...
So another way, but let me interrupt you. So in places like Sweden, there has been a recognition and a response to reorganizing society to accommodate people who are, in fact, living alone as adults so that they can have social contact on a regular basis, so they might not suffer the isolation, the depression, the loneliness, so they don't have the negative consequences that we are already feeling here.
And another thing that they do in these new housing units, which saves them money and allows for the cost of the housing unit, is that they have tasks that they have to do. You have to be on cleanup. You have to be on cooking. You have to be on something so that you meet
other people. So you're drawn into regular work with other people.
And are drawn into regular work with people, regular getting to know people according to what you can do. So if you're handicapped, you don't lead the fitness section. You do something else.
So if we were to close this interview, what would you recommend if there were a government and if there were a social condition in the United States that had a mind to deal with the real problems of actual people? What would you propose?
I would propose massive housing of this sort and to pay for it with the end of huge Medicare costs because people are happier, and also to tax the outrageous wealth overseas in protected areas and of the wildly wealthy in the United States to pay for these social experiments that will help people.
The irony is, you know, as an economist, it's the mechanisms of this economy that made such a small number of people extraordinarily wealthy that set in motion the very conditions that you're now suggesting we cope with by taxing that wealth that only exists because these people are now in this situation.
That's right, and ending the wars, so we could also make that, you know, $6 or $7 billion a week, we could save that.
All right, thank you very much, Dr. Harriet Fraud. In the little bit of time that remains in today's program, I want to deal with a couple of questions. These will be brief. Please don't be offended. It's because answering at a greater length is not only impossible because of time, but it's impossible because of the size of the question. So here's an interesting question from a young man in Florida. He asks me two questions. First, do you believe that it is inevitable that there will be a global economic collapse? Whoa. And his second question, what advice would you offer to a young individual getting out of college with $50,000 of student loan debt, a tough job market, credit card debt, and the fact that I will be coming off my parents' insurance within a year? Wow. Will there be a global economic collapse? My answer to that is we already got one. We're in one. We're in a crisis that began officially in December of 2007. That means we're halfway through the fifth year of this, and we opened today's program with a discussion of the unemployment data released yesterday that proved to us how deep this crisis is. So yes, there is a collapse. Is it a collapse that is the worst conceivable collapse? No, not yet. Who knows where it'll go? But we are in a breakdown of a global economic system that has a name, capitalism. It's not chic in our society to talk about that. We're not supposed to believe that the system is questionable, let alone that it's in a disastrous situation. But it ought to be questioned because it is in that situation. So I wouldn't say there will be an economic collapse. We're in one. The only question now is how bad will it get and how long will it last? What advice would I offer you? Well, you're describing a situation I hear about, since I teach in the university right now, from my students all the time. So the very least I can tell you is don't feel alone. You're part of an entire generation that has been told the following. The job market is tough, so you should get better credentials. You should go to school longer, get a degree, get more than one degree. And you've been told that as if two things made sense. One, that even though it's very expensive, more than ever, to go to school, it's worth it for you because you will get a job, and therefore you should borrow if you don't have the money, because that's the best strategy in a tough job situation. You've been told something that isn't true. Whether the person who told it to you knew it or not, or meant you any harm, is a different matter. But you were told something that is not the case. The job situation is awful. The difference it'll make to have a college degree is small. The cost to you of that debt will be lifelong. It isn't small, it's big. And therefore it's a very risky proposition you've entered into. And you're not going to solve it. Here's my most important comment. You're not going to solve it as an individual. You're going to sit there sweating it. If you're very lucky, you'll get a job. If you're even more lucky, it'll be big enough to enable you to repay your debts and live a reasonable life. That is eluding most people in your situation. Therefore, the only solution is a collective movement of people like you to say, this, we've been sold a bill of goods, and it's not acceptable. We're not going to pay back these loans, and there's a big movement already underway in this country to do that. Or we're demanding a jobs program that'll give us the kind of jobs and incomes that'll allow us to reasonably pay off these debts. One or the other, something's got to give. And if you're part of a movement of other people in your situation, and there are millions of them, that might be an achievable result. Otherwise, you will be struggling with this dilemma for the rest of your life. Last question for today. Can you give us your perspective on the banking crisis in Spain? Well, I did a little of that earlier. In particular, National Public Radio reported recently that the Spain's democratic community banks are in need of being rescued because they made these loans. And since those are like credit unions, is this an implicit criticism of credit unions, since I believe you have supported them? Let me respond very quickly. Most of the bank loans in Spain that are in question have been done by a whole raft of banks, private commercial banks, regional banks, local regional banks, national banks, and so on. They followed the same strategy of lending wildly to the housing market that we had here in the United States. They pushed those loans on people, often without explaining to them what the risks involve, what the cost would be. It's very similar to what happened in the United States. And now all these banks are in trouble, like they were here in the United States, and they're all turning to their government to bail them out, like they did here in the United States. There's really nothing special about any of that. Most of the local regional banks that you hear about, local savings banks, are not democratically organized or run. They often started that way, but many years ago they were changed around to become rather normal banks. But there is one exception. It's called the Caixa Laboral. And that's very interesting because, or the Caixa Laboral, and that's because it's part of the Mondragon system. It's a bank that is run cooperatively by the workers in it, that supports mainly other cooperative enterprises. Spain is the place where cooperative working has been developed more than any other country in the world on a mass basis. Roughly 105,000 people in Spain work in what is the seventh largest industry in the country, which is this Mondragon cooperative system, in every unit of which the workers make the decisions. The workers hire the managers and can fire them at will. Just to give you an idea, they work this way. The top executive in the firm gets no more than 4.5 times what the worker at the bottom gets. Here in the United States, by comparison, it's 300-1. And the bank run by them is in much better shape than all the other banks in Spain, because it has been very careful and because it runs on a cooperative basis. So the only thing that looks and works like a credit union is in pretty good shape in Spain, all the more remarkable given the collapse of the rest of the Spanish economy. Thank you very much for being with us. This is Economic Update. Thank you again.